For decades, the United States was the world leader in space exploration, but that role has been diminished greatly. Whereas our space shuttle program was terminated last summer, countries like Russia, China, and India continue to advance their programs. We're at a critical moment, says astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. He argues that despite concerns over the deficit, NASA's funding should be doubled at the very least. His latest book, Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier, is published by Norton, and I'm very pleased it has brought Neil deGrasse Tyson back to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. It's been a long time. Do you forget about me out there?
We used to have you on so regularly that people wondered whether there was some kind of
an arrangement
between us and the American Museum of Natural History. This book is a collection of interviews, articles, essays, speeches, tweets.
It's every thought I've ever had about past, present, and future in space. That's right.
And you seem to be all over the place these days. Science Friday, Morning Edition, The Takeaway, Jon Stewart's The Daily Show. Do you feel like a man on a mission?
Well, by the way, but you were one of my first ever interviews, right? Ever. So
yeah, well,
so
we kept inviting you back because you were good.
Spreading the love.
And also because most of the time I agree with you.
Okay. I don't like to think of myself on a mission. Usually when somebody's on a mission, they want everyone to do or think or say or feel what they think, say, or feel. And it's not that personal to me. It's more national. It's more cultural. We are failing in certain fundamental elements of what we'd all taken to be as our natural identity as Americans, as a species that would explore. And we're failing so badly, it forced me to take pause and say, what is behind that and how do we solve that on the premise that people would then embrace the solution?
But you know that right now it's kind of difficult to convince people to invest heavily in space exploration and research because of the deficits, because unemployment.
Because they view space as a luxury activity of scientists and engineers. If that's how you view it, then of course you would respond in exactly the way you described. I wouldn't blame them. If, in fact, that were the truth. But NASA, if you look at the conduct of NASA, what NASA does, what it has meant to the country, in particular, when NASA is advancing a space frontier, what do you have to do to advance a space frontier? You have to innovate, of course. Well, when you need to advance anything, you have to innovate. If you want to make the tallest building in the world, you have to innovate. The fastest planes, the fastest trains. By the way, where's the tallest building, the fastest planes, and the fastest trains? They're not in America. So there's a lot of innovating that is not going on in America today. And I submit that NASA is the greatest force to drive innovation of any.
The Super Collider isn't here either.
No, it's not here either. Exactly.
Although we did have an opportunity to build it here.
Yes, we did. In fact, we started. And the funds for that were summarily removed, ending the entire Super Collider plan. The Super Collider was started in the 1980s, and the whole budget was cut entirely in the early 1990s. What happened in 1989? Peace broke out. That's what happened.
The Cold War ended.
The Cold War.
So you're saying so much of our space program, well, it was obvious at the beginning. The Soviets sent up Sputnik, and then we felt national pride and also.
Well, it wasn't just pride. It was reactive. Sputnik was a hollowed-out intercontinental ballistic missile shell swapped with a radio transmitter that went beep. So the military folks understood the meaning of that. It was everyone else said, oh, isn't that nice? But it spooked America into a reaction mode. And reaction mode, a year later, NASA would be founded. Russia would beat us in practically every metric of space achievement. We forget that, right? The first non-human animal, the first human, the first woman, in fact, the first black person, the first space docking, the first space station. Go down the list. In fact, they even invented the rocket equation, the equation that describes how much fuel you need to launch a certain amount of payload into orbit. So they've been at this.
Does Vladimir Putin know this?
And so, I'll drop him a note. So much of what we did was reactive and a fear factor to the evil communists that were ready to take over the world. So fine, as it was. Meanwhile, we benefit economically from that drive. We innovate as a nation. We dream about tomorrow as a nation. The 1960s was all about, in spite of it being the bloodiest, most turbulent decades since the Civil War in America, when you combine the Cold War, Hot War, the student unrest, assassinations, all of that, the shining pearl of that decade was our missions to the moon. And that culture is what gave us the World's Fair. Jobs weren't going overseas back then, were they? Because they couldn't figure out what we were doing. We were innovating at a rate that was unmatchable.
Now, NASA has gotten involved in the whole climate change debate and other related matters. It became politicized. Didn't that hurt it?
Okay, so I don't mind politics. I mean, NASA was born out of a geopolitical climate. So politics itself is the driver of everything in Washington. You know, to the academic, politics is a barrier between where you are and where you want to go. In Washington, politics is the currency of interaction. So I'm not so naive as to be in denial of the role of politics. What concerns me of late is the role of partisanship in the conversations that surround NASA.
And that, it hasn't always been thus. You point out that when President Kennedy proposed the idea of landing man on the moon and returning him to Earth, we didn't have a launch vehicle. But when it finally went up, it was during the Nixon administration.
Yeah, exactly. So a Democrat launches the program, literally and figuratively, and we land on the moon under Nixon. I mean, so this was kind of natural exchange here. And so... And by the way, that if you look at Newt Gingrich's comments about putting a colony on the moon, the left-wing commentary was quick to say, Gingrich, colonies, you're completely clueless. You're out of it. Well, we've already been to the moon. So to imagine colonies 8 years after, at the end of his second term, of course, to imagine colonies 8 years after you begin your presidency when we've already been to the moon, that's not more extreme than Kennedy saying, let's land on the moon when we didn't yet have a vehicle. Yet it got partisan criticism because of it. And so I'm intrigued by this, but I'm disappointed because for NASA to succeed, it has to be nonpartisan. Not even bipartisan, but nonpartisan, as it's basically been for most of its 50-year history.
But it's all because of a sense of priorities. There are people who would say these things can be done somewhere in the future, but right now we have to fix things on Earth.
Yeah,
poverty, so, climate change, and the like. And Newt Gingrich is denying climate change, but he's saying let's do a Mars colony.
You fork up money to study the environment. Fine. Why are we even debating that? Of course. Whatever NASA's budget needs to be to do what we needed to do, make it that budget. And so one of the challenges that NASA has experienced over the decades after Apollo is more and more responsibilities have been put on NASA's shoulders. NASA was originally advancing a space frontier. One of those frontiers was low Earth orbit. That's not a frontier anymore. We've been there, done that. We understand the risks, the costs, all of the above. Yet NASA said, we need you to monitor Earth. Okay, I don't have a problem with that. Recognize it's not advancing a space frontier, however. We got to top up NASA's budget to do everything we need, wanted, and dreamed to do. I assert that a healthy NASA budget, twice what it is now, let's say, it's only a half a penny on your tax dollar, take it to a penny, a big fat penny. Take it to a penny, you'll have enough money to do everything we need NASA to do and go to Mars on a real time scale, not one that's maybe sometime in the 2030s by a president to be named later on a budget I haven't figured out yet. That's basically Obama's speech regarding going back to Mars, going to Mars for the first time with humans. So if you view NASA not as a luxury plan of scientists and engineers, but as something fundamental to our economic health, then it becomes an investment where you're looking for a return on that investment over the years to come.
You've been critical of the way the Obama administration has engaged our imagination with science and space exploration.
Critical not in the normal way that you think people like to criticize in a partisan way. I'm just frustrated that he gave two brilliant speeches. Well, you know, all the speeches are great and they're rousing the audience. He gave two great speeches. One of them was to the National Academy of Sciences. Another one was in his State of the Union address a year ago. And he leads off those speeches talking about the golden era of space exploration and what impact it had to innovate our science and technology frontier and what impact it had on the educational pipeline. Then no money follows to feed NASA. Or a little bit of money came in. He topped off NASA's budget for 1 year, and then it went back to what it was before. He talks about topping up other science agencies, and I'm all for it. National Science Foundation, the Department of Energy Physics, go for it. The National Institutes of Standards and Technology, even though nobody's heard of them, they're really important. Scientists know that. Fine. You top up those agencies. What effect will that have on The population? None, because nobody's ever heard of these agencies. But we've all heard of NASA.
Now, what has this meant for employment? For example, I know an astronaut who is retired because she really sees no future.
Yeah, we're still sending astronauts into orbit, but we're hitching a ride with
the
Russians.
Yeah, we're going.
Actually, hitching is the wrong word, because when you hitch a ride, you get to ride for free. We're going on the Russian Soyuz, and we're paying big dollars for it. And that's just embarrassing. I'm sorry. I could live with it, but it's just embarrassing. I want to, like, get my next vehicles ready to launch so we can minimize that time.
Now, why does the money have to come from the government? Are the public-private partnerships we see emerging today incapable of the research that you think is necessary?
Two things. There's been a lot of misunderstanding regarding the private sector. Let me just set a foundational comment here. NASA has always been in partnership with the private sector from the very beginning. Just as an easy but very visible example, the LEM, the Lunar Excursion Module, that was designed and built by Grumman here on Long Island, in New York. So this relationship between NASA monies and their feeding the industrial complex has been a fundamental dimension of NASA throughout its entire life. Now you want to go forward. I don't have a problem with that. What you do is you seed things that NASA has already done and figured out how to do and assess the risks to the capital markets, to private enterprise. Go ahead. If that's low Earth orbit, go ahead. You want to take us to the space station? Go ahead. But it is delusional to imagine that private enterprise will lead a space frontier. That will never happen. It can never happen because it's expensive, it's dangerous, and the risks are unmeasured. And when you have those three combined, you cannot enter it into the capital markets, because the capital markets are investors trying to get a return on that investment. So governments take the first steps that are risky. Governments sent Columbus across the Atlantic so he can draw the maps, assess the risks, find out if there are riches there. And then the Dutch East India Trading Company and all other commerce followed that.
Spain became rich as a result.
This
of
is how
raping the Latin America.
Well, that's the hegemonistic valuation of it. Now, of course, Columbus himself was a discoverer. But the people who wrote the checks, they are not. They have other objectives in mind, be they military or economic.
The Enterprise space shuttle is scheduled to arrive at the Intrepid Museum
in
late April.
I can't wait.
But is this an example of how we're moving from having a space program to having exhibits that celebrate past glories?
Yeah, I remember when the last space shuttle was launched, Atlantis, and I was actively tweeting at the time, and I saw some tweets go across my view, and one said, "Oh, I'm shedding a tear because it's the end of an era. I said, "No, that's not why you're shedding a tear. You're not shedding a tear because the space shuttle is ending. You're shedding a tear because another vehicle is not awaiting a next generation of launch missions on the next launch pad. Nobody shed a tear when Gemini ended, because the mighty Saturn V was sitting right next door. We're shedding a tear because, not that the shuttle's ending, but there's nothing staring at us to continue that adventure.
Aren't there plans for something?
Yes, there
is,
for 2020. Might be, if we're lucky, that'll be the next ship that'll go take us back to the space station. And then in the 2030s, maybe something to Mars, by a president to be named later, like I said, on a budget not even yet established.
My guest is Neil deGrasse Tyson, an eminent astrophysicist, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. You've seen him on television, you've heard him all over radio, and now he has a new book, a collection of various writings called Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. It's edited by Avis Lang. Let's talk about some other things. Well, they all relate to the concept of the space frontier. You say that there are more planets than the sum of all utterances made by humans since the beginning of time.
Yeah, that's right. By the way, the book is not only just me ranting about NASA and its budget, but I try to give people a sense of how to think about the universe so that you can long for these changes, as well as learn about how to make them happen.
Now, should we assume that they're all pretty much the same, that all the atoms in the universe, or 90% of the atoms in the universe, are hydrogen atoms?
Yeah, so it's what's one of the fascinating facts about modern astrophysics is our ability to deduce the chemical composition of objects halfway or entirely across the universe. It was once supposed by a philosopher that the astronomer would only ever be able to look up at night and see how bright something is, what color it is, and where it is on the sky, but its contents will be forever removed from us. And, of course, he was wrong, as many philosophers are when they don't walk into a lab. If all your thinking is done sitting in a chair, you're not really useful on the advancing frontier. We use spectra. We take the light from a star, pass it through a prism, essentially, a fancy prism, look at the component colors, and those component colors have a trove of information about what its chemical composition is and the like.
Even the earliest ones, that we see from just the days after the Big Bang.
Exactly. As you look far out in space, you're looking back in time, and so we see not only the ingredients of the periodic table of elements in the present, we see those ingredients in the past. But there's less and less of them as you go back to the Big Bang. Big Bang gave us three ingredients, hydrogen, helium, little bit of lithium.
So what happened? Work out combinations?
Nice question. These gas molecules, these gas particles collapse into stars, and the stars undergo thermonuclear fusion and manufacture one by one those elements on the periodic table.
Now, you're talking about the space frontier here, but we can't travel very far. I mean, it would take us, at the speed of light, it would take us a very long time to get to Alpha Centauri, the nearest universe.
Yeah, of course, your time wouldn't advance as we would watch you take 4 years, but if you're at the speed of light, you'd get there, you know, very quickly, essentially.
If we could ever do anything the speed of light.
If you're at the speed of light, you'd get there instantly. Yeah. But anything less, it would take you basically 4 years to get there. So we watch you take 4 years to get there. For you, it would take arbitrarily shorter and shorter amounts of time. And it's relativity. We knew this since 1905. So humans going to other planets, other star systems, is a little out of reach right now. But we still don't even know our own backyard. I want to turn the solar system into our backyard. I want to take NASA, tool it up with all manner of space vehicles so we can go to the moon for either science or geopolitical reasons or maybe for economic reasons. You want to mine it, whatever. I want to go to an asteroid, one is going to have our name on it.
Well, you want to start mining the other planets? Horrified by that.
Why are you horrified? We mine Earth, and that's the one we live on. Why do you care if we mine another planet? The universe is big. Are you saying, let's just mess up Earth, leave the rest of the universe untouched? If we need resources, let's use it. We're using solar resources now. We're taking solar energy from it that would have otherwise head out into space. I don't have a problem with that. I mean, we'd want to regulate it in ways that we regulate it here. You don't mess up an environment that you might want to live in, you know. So it's the normal thing that humans have done when they discover new lands.
So you want to go to all of the other planets? Well, some of them, of course, you can't land on.
Well, you can land on moons that orbit them, and so you can still study them from base stations on rocky moons rather than the gaseous planets
themselves. And then we could find out once and for all whether Pluto is a planet. I don't want to get into that. That was what
we
discussed.
Hold me back.
What we discussed the last time you were here. It wasn't all that long ago.
A year and a half ago, something like that.
When people were really on your tail for saying that Pluto was not a planet.
I think most of them have gotten over it. If not, get over it.
Well, this leads us, of course, to the whole matter of whether there's life outside. You're assuming that there is life on this infinite number of other planets.
If you look at the age of the universe and the ingredients of life and how quickly life got started on Earth, combine those three facts, you'd be inexcusably egocentric or otherwise philosophically driven by a narrow worldview to deny that we're not alone in the universe.
I read somewhere that most scientists conjecture that if there is life on other planets, it would most likely be in the form of some kind of slime.
Possibly. Most of the history of Earth, if you use Earth as a template, it's all we have, so why not? Most of the time you throw a dart at the Earth timeline, you'll hit life when it was slime. When it was, you know, bacterial slime on, you know, pond scum. 3 billion years worth of bacteria.
I have
life.
Some neighbors who still.
So life didn't get interesting until about half a billion years ago, the Great Cambrian Explosion. That's the appearance of eyes and limbs and differentiated organs.
Well, would we assume that similar things would happen elsewhere?
Maybe not.
We can't imagine shapes other than squares and circles.
I know. So I'm saying it could be really different from that. But if Earth is any measure of anything, then I'm saying that most of the time you'll come upon the life of a planet and the history of life on that planet, you'll hit it with single-celled life. That's all, if Earth is a measure. If Earth is not a measure, I don't know where to even start that conversation.
Well, you also say there's a good chance that an alien species we would encounter would be hostile.
Well, my argument there is, I mean, I, I've in reaction to Stephen Hawking when he said, you know, why don't send out our return address because they'll come and suck our brains out. I paraphrase, obviously. If aliens treat us the way we treat ourselves, they'll be hostile.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
And of course, there was that wonderful television show of To Serve Mankind.
Oh, To Serve Man. Yes, yes. That was an episode of The Twilight Zone, mm-hmm. To Serve Man, where aliens came to visit. I shouldn't give away the plot. Aliens come to visit
Earth.
Oh,
that's okay. I think.
You think it's 50 years later I can give away the plot? Aliens come to visit Earth, and they teach Earthlings how to – they have higher technology, and so they teach us how to have abundant crops. All hunger goes away. Our technologies work. We don't even have to work normal jobs because everything is provided for us, and we get fat and happy. And then we're invited to visit their home planet, and we would later learn that on their home planet – they're eating us.
To Serve Man
to
is
serve
a cookbook.
Man.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's also the matter of asteroids. Earth has been hit by asteroids in the past.
So if discovery of really cool cosmic phenomenon and objects and ideas are not interesting to you, and if even pumping the American economy doesn't tweak your interest, you don't mind dying poor, okay. But how about the asteroid that would one day come and render us extinct?
You say statistically we're just as likely to die in a plane crash as in an asteroid
strike. Yeah,
that's
right.
But there have been a number of asteroid strikes throughout Earth's history, nothing recently, and we have had many plane crashes.
Yeah, so the way that statistic, you have to sort of see how it was constructed. So if 100 people a year die in plane crashes, so you multiply that by 100 million years, you get, 10 billion?
You're the mathematician.
And so I think I did my math right there. And one asteroid the size of what took out the dinosaurs comes about once every 100 million years and will kill all 10 billion people on Earth.
The asteroid Apophia?
Oh, no. Apophis? The one that took out the dinosaurs. That's the one that was about the size of Mount Everest. That one rendered 70% of all species extinct. So if every 100 million years an asteroid renders 70% of all species extinct, then... that's the killing of 10 billion people by a single asteroid.
Although mammals seem to survive better than some of the other species.
We've done quite well, and I'm always intrigued by the size range that you can find mammals to be. Mammals are the largest animals ever to live on Earth. The blue whale is, compare that to the size of one of these tiny monkeys that fits in a coffee cup. And there's a huge range of size among mammals, or a mouse, or a tree shrew. And so mammals can be quite adaptive, and that's a good thing, I think. But we have at a huge cost, we have an enormous appetite. We have to maintain our body temperature against the colder temperatures of the air around us. So we're eating constantly. Alligator, chicken a month, it's fine. we're eating three times a day. And when we're done eating, we're planning the next meal.
But it seems obvious that too large is not the best thing. The very large dinosaurs all died off.
Except those dinosaurs thrived on Earth for 300 million years.
Well, but mammoths also, we have smaller animals today, even if the whale is an exception.
When there's catastrophe, it's always better to be small. Yeah, when the asteroid that took out the dinosaurs hit, nothing bigger than a suitcase survived.
So let's talk about the asteroid that some people think might threaten Earth in the year 2029, Apophis 1.
Apophis. Yeah,
Apophis.
So that's going to come. We know it's not going to hit in 2029. We know enough about its orbit to say that. But it is going to get closer than our orbiting communication satellites. It's about the size of the
Rose Bowl. So could that move? Could the gravitational pull of it actually have an impact on Earth's?
No pun intended, for sure, yeah. An impact. So the real question is, what effect? No, it's like a gnat flying full speed into the side of an elephant. The elephant will not notice the gnat. The question is, what does the gravity of the Earth have on its trajectory as it goes by Earth? And depending on where it actually passes us among the set of trajectories that remain uncertain, a subset of those trajectories, if it threads that keyhole, it will hit us 7 years later on April 13th, 2036. And it would likely then hit the Pacific Ocean and take out the entire west coast of North America.
Do you think that we have taken
our... Have a nice day, yes.
Okay. So what would we do? We'd send up Clint Eastwood to shoot the thing down?
No, Bruce Willis. So you got to see the right movie on this one. So what gets me is that many people say, well, you know, stockpile toilet paper and buy all the water and build shelters. I don't need those people around me. I want people who say, how can we deflect that asteroid? Those are the people who are scientifically trained. And those are the people, such as who NASA hires, who would know how to do such a thing.
Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, deflect it. We've got the solution on paper already. You get a spaceship to go and station keep next to it. You park it next to it. They feel each other's gravity. The spaceship prevents itself from falling in by using little retro rockets. And the act of not falling in slowly tugs the asteroid out of harm's way. It doesn't destroy it. It's there to kill another day, but it'll take it out of that orbital hazardous path.
Now, when I was a kid, I think every kid wanted to draw a rocket. Do you find it problematic that most people don't classify themselves as science and math people or space enthusiasts today?
Yes, I do, and I think if NASA made a bold statement that fully funded with a near-term goal of going to Mars with a budget that matches that will galvanize the nation in the way that we were galvanized in the early 1960s. We choose that next astronaut class. How old are they today? They're like in middle school. Go choose them now. So find out, are they eating well? Are their grades good? And you can change the culture of America to be one of discovery rather than one of just living for the day.
Well, you're talking about the ultimate frontier. What about the ultimate frontier that we're working on Earth, finding out trying to come up with some kind of unified theory, find out whether string theory works, whether there's a Higgs boson or not.
Okay, the theorists who do that, they're really cheap. You give them a pencil, a laptop, a pad, you're fine. They're not even in the budgeting equation here. In order to find the Higgs boson, you use a large particle accelerator. That's what's going on in Europe
now. And that costs billions of dollars.
And that's billions, but even by comparison to space exploration, that's relatively cheap. Which was one of the great tragedies in America, where we didn't even finish building our own. We started, but then didn't finish our own particle accelerator.
You'll be testifying before Congress this coming Wednesday.
I just learned a few days ago I was invited to testify in front of the Senate.
Along with the current head of NASA.
He testifies first in his own session, and then I have a session where it's only me and their committee.
And what are you going to tell
them? The Senate Commerce Committee that oversees the budget for NASA. They've seen some of these broadcasts. You know, I've been like on this horse over the last 10 days, and they want me to share those perspectives with that committee and all assembled. Because I could rage on about the current NASA budget, but what I really want to talk about is what the budget needs to be going forward so that it can solve the problems that people have otherwise identified to be separate and distinct, when in fact I see them all looped together in the absence of our initiative to innovate.
If people want to follow your tweets.
Oh, yeah. So I tweet. They're mostly cosmic brain droppings. It's just I have a thought and I say, oh, let me share that with the Twitterverse. And maybe 10 times a week I have one of these thoughts. And it's I tweet at Neil Tyson, NEILTYSON.
And also Neil deGrasse Tyson will be speaking at the American Museum of Natural History on March 15th at 7 p.m. For more information about that, visit our show page at WNYC.org. A couple of our listeners have left questions on our show page about SpaceX, a private company. Well, we already kind of addressed that.
Well, that's good. I mean, I think people think SpaceX is going to replace NASA. That's, like I said, that's just not going to happen.
And another listener wants to know about a reboot of the Cosmos series.
Oh, thanks for asking. Yes, I'm actively I've collaborated with two of the original three creative principals of the original Cosmos. Carl Sagan is dead, of course, but Andrian and Steve Soter are my creative collaborators. We also have a great producer named Mitch Kenold, and we're scripting now. We expect to be in production by the end of the year, and it'll take a year from then, so end of 2013, 2014, and 13 episodes, and it'll actually air on Fox.
Neil deGrasse.
You paused there.
You leave me speechless. Neil deGrasse Tyson. Well, you know, a lot of fantasy there.
There's blood coming out of your ears right now.
The book Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. It is published by Norton.
I got to tell you, wait, quick. I got a tweet. Someone said, Fox, they're a bunch of like nitwits on Fox. And I said, that's why we're putting it on Fox.
Well, a number of those people are in outer space, but right. That's a whole other matter. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.